I'm going to meander a bit because it has occurred to me that I have been given the opportunity that every man who reaches my old, my senior citizen's status dreams of. Somebody is going to actually listen to me when I talk. And in fact, I keep getting encouraged to keep putting programs on. Well, when you tell an old guy to do that, to talk, if he's an old Southern guy like me, you have really asked for it. The wonderful thing about this technology is that out on the porch down south, when the old guy started wandering around and talking the way he wanted to, all the young people around would have to act like they were interested and wait until he nodded off to sleep for a couple of minutes so they could sneak off the porch. You don't have to do that. You can just not listen. Now, the first point I wanted to talk about as a former addict, alcoholic, you name it, is the subject of what you might call natural drugs. It occurred to me, my brother, by the way, is a doctor, and he made a remark one time that people seem to think that just because a drug is produced by your body, like adrenaline, that you can't become addicted to it. Just because you don't shoot it into your veins, you can't get addicted to it. Well, there are plenty of adrenaline addicts out there. I was on speed and alcohol and ended up in concentrated rehab. But a couple of other drugs that I was addicted to in my years in Washington and in Africa and all those other places was a combination of what is called an exhaustion high. This sounds like a contradiction, but your body puts out chemicals when you're exhausted, when you're tired. And, of course, an exhaustion high was combined, and in my case, was always combined with lots of adrenaline, fear, guilt, and I came to realize that I was addicted to that. I was addicted to working 100 hours a week under pressure, taking risks, driving myself crazy, really. And those particular drugs were not shot into my veins. I produced them. But the net result was addiction. And I just thought it'd be good, first of all, to mention that to you, that for example, that one does, in fact, become addicted. A lot of people who exercise become addicted to adrenaline. They get a shot when they're out there running and so forth. That's why they seem so happy. They are happy. They're high. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. There's nothing whatsoever wrong with generating good chemicals. But it's just like medicine. If any good medicine, almost any medicine that works, is also a poison. Depends on how much you use of it, when you use it. And that isn't just the drugs that you take. That's the drugs that you induce inside yourself. Another thing that occurred to me, I haven't heard anybody else mention, maybe because I didn't see it, but I'm going to be 65 years old at the end of this month. It occurred to me that if at this moment I were suddenly 20 years old and I had all of the same testosterone level and all of the other chemicals and the circulation, heart circulation and so forth, all those things going through me at this moment suddenly that a 20-year-old has, I would be drunk as a skunk. I'd be high as a kite. I couldn't take them. Everybody, once again, this is an odd-sounding thing. But the fact is, I would probably just be drunk if I got hit with all those youth chemicals that are normal in a young man. I'd probably be babbling even worse than I am now. When you get my age, you often think that young people are acting like they're drunk. And you may be right. The question, of course, is which one is acting oddly? I mean, I'm acting like I'm old. Is that actually better than acting like you're drunk? You do get calmer as you get older. But that's not an objective state. That is evolution. But it is all, I mean, that's just aging, of course. A lot of the chemicals that were driving me when I was 20 are not in my system now. As I understand it, morphine, for example, that you eat when you shoot it or however you take it, morphine or any opiate does not in itself act on your system. It stimulates your natural chemicals in your brain. So all that it does is stimulate your own glands to produce I think it's called endomorphs, that are pleasurable. The fact that your own brain or your own glands produce it doesn't make an opiate any nicer than, say, cocaine that operates directly on your system. I did get myself addicted to the exhaustion high, the chemicals, whatever the hell they are that you get with exhaustion, and the combination of that with adrenaline. So I wasn't just addicted to the alcohol that I drank or the speed that I took or whatever else I hit myself with. I was addicted to the drugs that I generated in my own system. I remember when I was young, we had what we called a Holy Roller Church across the road from the brick plant. And they invited us over, and we went over there. And Holy Roller, well, I'm a South Carolinian, so maybe I'm a little biased about that, but let me tell you, down here in the Deep South, a real Holy Roller, when I was young, was exactly that. I think if you ever watched The Blues Boys or any of those, that movie with the, when the black people were singing and raising Cain for the Lord, they were actually very reserved compared to the Holy Rollers I was around. I mean, they were, in fact, rolling. Their eyes were rolling. Some of them were rolling on the ground. They were jumping. They were screaming. They were in an ecstasy. Not one of them, well, not many of them, would have touched alcohol or any other drug. But let me tell you something. If I could get as high, if I could have gotten as high with the drugs their own body was producing when they were really going at it, holy rolling, praising the Lord and really going to pieces, I would never have needed to touch any other drug. But again, all those drugs were being produced inside them. Those holy rollers were in a delirium. They were gushing with chemical compounds inside them. And maybe, as a Bible belter, I have to come to the defense of my own before people start laughing at this. The fact of the matter is that maybe the drugs I took were a substitute for the faith I should have had. I see a lot of country preachers, well, some are still left, who may have been plumbers. Avis Hill was a plumber, one of my buddies and one of the people I worked with in the Kanawha County textbook controversies. But he was touched by God, and there's no question about it. He didn't have his seminary education. He didn't have orders from any particular church. He was a man touched by God. And this is from a man, Bob Whitaker, who is 99% atheist. But if somebody could convert me, it would be someone who had actually been touched by God, or at least I'd feel like it, that all the university degrees and all the doctors of divinity and all the cardinal's robes and all in the world couldn't substitute for that. Way down in my gut, I am a Bible belter. So before you start having the usual laugh at these holy rollers, I suggest the possibility that I ended up on drugs because I didn't have their faith. And of course, as I said with medicines, a medicine is normally a poison, depending on how much you take. Maybe the holy rollers were overdoing it. But I certainly know that in my own case, had I had a better faith in someone or something, I would not have been on the drugs I was on the alcohol I was on. In fact, the first thing you have to do when you go to Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous is recognize a higher power. This is a very complicated idea, but the fact is you really do have to have some kind of faith in something or someone. And this is why I have such a strong personal grudge against the group that calls itself the Greatest Generation. We were facing, at the end of World War II, we were facing the Bolshevists, the Communists. We were beginning to get this idea that since Hitler was for the survival of the white race, then anybody who cared about his race, if he was white, was a Nazi. We were being faced with integration, and integration was a step towards our present situation where, as I keep saying, there is this so-called race problem, and everybody accepts the idea that this race problem only exists in white countries. The solution, the final solution to this race problem, is that there should be massive third world immigration, non-white immigration, into every white country and only into white countries. This is the final solution to the white problem. Japan and Taiwan have less people per square mile than Belgium or the Netherlands do. But it turns out it's just the Netherlands and Belgium that need to assimilate, quote unquote, with these non-whites that have to pour in by the millions. Well, I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure out that we are the race problem. And I personally, under no conditions ever, will accept the final solution to my race. Period. Full stop, as the British say. So, why do I have this personal grudge against the group that calls itself the Greatest Generation? Because they were the people that I, as a young man, should have been able to look up to. They were the people who would stand in the way of the destruction of my race. The people who would stand for all the things that we had before. And, as I keep repeating here, all they had learned from World War II was that the sergeant was always right, that authority was always right. Half of them went straight from a military youth based on blind obedience to the universities, in which they learned to obey the professors. But, and I keep repeating this, old Bob is an old man, he keeps repeating things when he hits what he thinks is the truth. The World War II veterans that a lot of us knew, who were pro-white, were worse than the ones who were commies, the ones who were anti-white, and I'll tell you why. They never stood up to the enemy. Whenever one of us young people would stand up for our Confederate flag, the World War II generation would say, "Oh, we're one country now. I learned that in World War II." And whenever we tried to stand up to authority, they would say, "Well, yeah, you want to, but let me tell you, I learned that you can't fight City Hall." Pat Buchanan, back in the 1970s, on Crossfire, I keep getting it mixed up with Bill Buckley's Firing Line, but it was Crossfire. He and his pet liberal were, Bradley, I think his name was, were having the token racist. They have the token racist now. They have this token racist on there, and Pat Buchanan announced out of the clear blue sky that American soldiers died in World War II in order to open Europe to third world immigration. Now, that was a little bit stunning. I mean, come on, gang. But that's what the man said. And Bradley, the pet liberal there, just praised him to the skies for making that statement, that Americans had fought against the reason that guys from Georgia and South Carolina had gone out there and gotten themselves killed on Normandy Beach was so that Pakistanis and people from Ghana could pour into Europe. Well, that's just a little bit nuts. But I talked to Pat later, years later, and I asked him, did any of the World War II veterans object to this? Now, I knew one World War II veteran. He talked about how he had fought against racism and he was for integration and all that. And he said that they fought against racism. Then, at one point, he was talking about a buddy of his who literally died in his arms. A guy from Georgia. And I said, was this guy an integrationist? And he said, no, he was an old Georgia boy. He was a white supremacist. And I said, but I've never heard you object when one of these old despicable clowns running around in little paper hats, you know, these little veterans' hats, would say, all our men, they died against racism. I said, don't you think you might owe it to your buddy there to say, this boy from Georgia, he did not die in your arms so that Europe would be flooded with Pakistanis? And he just hadn't thought of that. I remember one of many examples where one of these old clowns with the World War II veteran's hat that's shaped like army hats, and when the question of the borders and border patrol came up, he said, I and my comrades, we fought a war so there wouldn't be discrimination like that. In other words, all those guys that died in the war, he said, were fighting to, as Pat Buchanan said, to bring the Third World into Europe. Well, I forget exactly where I left myself here, but I asked Pat Buchanan, I said, did any of the World War II veterans, because Pat had changed his mind by that time, did any of these World War II veterans raise bloody hell about your saying that their comrades died right there in front of them so that Europe would be full of Third Worlders? And Pat said, no. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why I have a personal grudge against the group that calls itself the Greatest Generation. They, and as I say, I have more of a grudge. I don't have quite as much a grudge against honest communists or those who were quite openly for the destruction of the white race. And by the 1960s, most of the vocal people were. The ones that I really despise are the ones who had healthy views, but it just wasn't convenient for them to express them. Moral absolute cowardice. Now let's go back to this thing about a higher power, about faith. I was a young man. I needed faith in something. the people who should have provided me with that guidance were the group that calls itself the Greatest Generation, a more concentrated group of total cowards in moral terms has never existed on the planet Earth. I don't like them. Now let me repeat something. I put this in Stormfront, and a lot of people seem to be deaf. I thought we old people were the ones who were deaf. But let me repeat it again and again. You know that I had family that was out in the Pacific in World War II in the Marines. And these people have very fond memories of members of their family, and so do I, who served heroically, not just honorably, when they were soldiers. I'm not talking about the soldiers. I am talking about a generation of veterans who were absolute, crawling, cringing, drooling moral cowards. These moral cowards were not the anti-whites or the communists. They were precisely my uncles, who were very brave in the Pacific, in the Marines, and so forth, and whose ideas were straight and true. That is what made them so bad. So let's get a couple of things straight. First of all, I'm not talking about soldiers. I'm talking about veterans. Secondly, I am saying that the cringing cowards in whom I should have been able to have faith were precisely my uncles, your granddaddies, whoever it is, who came back from World War II, had good, solid ideas, was not warped mentally, but they just would never speak up. They would never fight back. Now, let me say up front that the World War II generation was not my excuse for falling back on drugs, alcohol, and the other drugs. Well, as I said, the exhaustion highs and the adrenaline rushes that I became addicted to. If they had never existed, I would have still fallen back on those things. They did not cause that. They are not responsible for that. The fact is that a drug is not addictive. The person is addictive. At least that's my feeling about it. But what I learned in the program, what I learned from thinking back over my life, was not anything about really alcohol or drugs. It was the importance of faith. I realized that it is critical, it is fundamental to any human being that he must be able to have faith in something or someone. And in that area, the group that calls itself the Greatest Generation let me down terribly. And what this has built into me is a determination that young people today who see and feel their world coming apart, who see and feel their race being threatened are not going to be able to say that Bob Whitaker, for all his faults, ever wavered in his total backing of them. That wrong and genocide against our race is something that I will fight, I will use whatever means I have, and I've developed pretty good means, to back them morally. I learned how important faith is. And faith, as I say, can be in God. I hope that I will be granted that. But faith in your elders, faith in their being willing not to tell you that they have outgrown faith, and that is too often what passes for the wisdom of the elders in our day. They call it diplomacy. Well, diplomacy is always a lie. They call it discretion. And it's one of my private jokes. I tell people that I'm not actually a coward, but I am loaded with discretion. You know, discretion is the better part of valor. Discretion is the better part of valor. Well, I may not have valor. I may run away when the shooting starts. That's because I am absolutely loaded with discretion. That's a joke. And the World War II generation, the veterans, not the soldiers, the veterans, were just absolutely loaded with discretion. I remember that every time I tried to stand up against integration for the South, for the sort of natural feelings that a man has, that a white man has when he sees a blonde girl with a black guy, every time I tried to stand up for those feelings, the group that called itself the Greatest Generation not only didn't back me up, they said, "Well, I learned when I was in the Army that you can't fight this sort of thing. You have to learn to bend with the wind," and so forth, and so on, ad nauseum. I would like to be the sort of person who doesn't bend with the wind. If I break, so what? But when I was in AA and NA, one nice thing I found was that a lot of young people wanted me to be their sponsor. And that's a little hard to explain to people outside the program, but since I was flat on my retail section when I crawled into the program, it made me feel good that I could do a lot of good, because a lot of people wanted me to sponsor them, to advise them, the person to whom they confessed everything. And that is the position that I took long before I ever entered the program, all my life, I have decided firmly that I will not be anything like the weakest generation. I will support resistance. I will support healthy instincts. And I'll stick my neck out. I'll stick it out a long way. And any young people who need an old guy that's going to back them up, well, old Whit is not smart, but he's loyal. And this is a reaction to a betrayal from a whole generation of people that I truly, deeply despise. Not the soldiers, not the young men who went out to fight, but the drooling cowards who came home. Well, I guess I've repeated myself. I said this before in The Weakest Generation. But in my own way, it's a declaration of loyalty. It's a declaration to you that I am not going to back down. I am not going to counsel you to deny your instincts. And that one that everybody says is so unsophisticated. If you see a black guy with a blonde girl, you're not supposed to get upset about it. The simple fact is that in fact, our destiny is our women. And when a woman is running around with a mixed blood baby, she is actually helping destroy us. So, the fact is that your instincts, you young people's instincts, are perfectly correct. Don't let anyone convince you they're supposed to listen to the professors, you're supposed to bend with the wind. If you bend, you are the men, you are the ones who are not supposed to bend with the wind. And if I can help you to resist, if I can give you the kind of moral courage, a little bit of the moral courage that was denied to me by the weakest generation, then I will be honored to provide it. This is Bob Whitaker with Porch Talk, and I hope you'll listen to me again.